In conversation with Dean on City Talk 105.9.
And this week I'm in conversation with Philip Townsend, who's here ahead of his new exhibition that opens in Chester this evening. Good afternoon, Philip.
Good afternoon.
Yes, tell us about your exhibition, an exhibition of your photographs.
Yes, my photographs I took in the 1960s.
Yes, and how many are on show there, the exhibition?
It's at the Watergate Gallery, and there are 40.
OK, and have you had a sneak preview? Do you know what it's looking like?
Yeah, I chose them.
Have I? But have you actually seen it in situation?
No,
have you been over there yet?
No,
right,
no,
OK.
No,
okay,
no.
So,
it's a lovely gallery, so I'm sure they look...
Yeah,
they look really
right
good.
There in the heart of Chester.
Yes.
So yes, there's the photos. I was looking on your webpage.
Yes.
Earlier at these, they certainly capture the essence of the 60s, don't they?
I think they do. I think that most of the photographers of the 60s work for newspapers, and I work for the Daily Express. But you take pictures for newspapers to fit the space. And I have always taken pictures to have the background in and interesting things around the time of when they were taken. So, A, you can tell when they were taken, and B, in the future, you'll know what it looked like, because everything changes so much.
Of course, I was looking, like I said, on the webpage, and I was looking at some photos of the Rolling Stones. Tell us how you came to meet
Those
them.
Are the very first pictures of the Rolling Stones, which I took 5 days after Andrew Lew Goldham, who was the first manager... signed them in May 1963. In 1961, I'd been in Monte Carlo for Tatler magazine, and while I was sitting around in the square one day, this guy walked in, very young, and sort of, you know, in jeans and riding breeches, I sometimes say, but it was jeans, and he sat down, and he said, I started talking to him, and he said, "Oh, I've been working for Mary Quant." Well, Mary Quant, even in 1961, was the designer. You know, she was the first of the 60s designers. And I thought, oh, yes, 18-year-old lad working for her. We believe you. And it turned out that he'd been her gopher. And so he said, "Rock and roll is the thing. Rock and roll is what it's going to be. And when I go back to England... I'm going to find a rock and roll band, well, rhythm and blues, but rock and roll, and I'm going to turn them into the greatest rock and roll band in the world." And from that moment, I believed him, because he was so convincing, so talented at 18. And, I mean, I'm still great friends with him. And 45 years later, he's still exactly the same.
Is he still doing the same job?
No, he's living in... He had a problem with white powder, and he moved to Colombia. But it was
seems rather apt.
Well, that's probably the reason he went. And his wife had a bit of a problem. But in 1996, he worked out that it was costing them $200,000 a year.
Wow.
The two of them. Because he was he was threatened by the local dealers that if he went on buying from the local dealers, he was threatened by the wholesalers that if he went on buying from the local wholesalers, because it was cheaper, he'd get killed. So he started having to buy retail, and the price was too much, and he got fed up with it anyway, and it was affecting his life. And he went to Connecticut and he met this guy, and I know it's terrible, but he did it, and he's a Scientologist. And he is the only person I've ever met who's had a severe coke problem, you know, because it's so moody, you're up one moment, you're down the next. And he's been cured, and he's just fantastic, he's never been better. Doesn't forget things anymore. He's coming over next month, and he's going to... Guy who used to, the guy who died, Wilson, who owned the hacienda, he's the keynote speaker. Tony Wilson. At his, every year they have a conference, and he's the keynote speaker there. So I'll see him next month. But he's been in Colombia since 1963.
And how did this sort of cure just sort of happen overnight?
No, he did all the courses. Well. it was costing $200,000 a year, and this guy said, "You do all the courses. You do all the courses. That cost you $400,000." And he's very shrewd, and he worked it out. They would do it for 2 years, and I'll be in profit. And so that's what he did, and he's a different person.
I'm in conversation this hour with my special guest, celebrity photographer Philip Townsend, talking about his friend who literally discovered the Rolling Stones.
Absolutely.
Where did he find them then?
He found them at Eel Pie Island in Richmond. He'd heard about them. He had no musical contacts at all. And he'd heard about them. So he went down to see them. And there was a guy called Giorgio Gomorski, who was a Russian, who had agreed to sign them up. And it's a sad story, really, because Giorgio went to Paris for his mother's funeral, which was on Saturday. Andrew went down there on Sunday. Giorgio was coming back on Tuesday. So he said, "Come on, boys, I'm going to sign you. You want me? I'll be great." On all the old spiel. And they believed him, like everyone else does. And he signed them up, and that was it. On Monday, he signed them up. I took the pictures on Friday.
So how long was he with them for? Was he effectively their manager?
He was their manager, and Mick Jagger, even though he really set Mick Jagger up writing songs with Keith, and he made them lots and lots of money in the first few years. I mean, the stuff from 1963 to 1967 is the stuff that is still the real popular stuff, songs. And so he signed them up, and he created them. And he said, "We're going to have this mean image." Well, the very first pictures that I took were of them wearing their own clothes.
This was on the Friday. They were signed up on the Monday.
They were signed on Monday. I took pictures on the following Friday.
Right, okay.
And on that Saturday, the next day, he'd got them into Battersea Pleasure Gardens, which was still sort of half in use then, as the star act with David Frost. that was within 4 or 5 days of booking them up.
So you took the first photos. And what were they like then, the Rolling Stones?
Well, they'd never been photographed before. They'd never done a demo.
So they were very raw then?
They'd never been managed. And, yeah, if you on the website, if you look at those pictures, they look perplexed, I think. They didn't know how to pose. But they were very, you know, like now, you try and take their photographs and they tell you to... Well, what you can do with yourself. But in those days, when they first started, they knew... None of them were silly. They knew, to get to the top, they had to play along with Andrew. And that's what they did.
One of the photos that caught my eye was each of them standing back-to-back with a red... well, it's not red because they're in black and white. Telephone boxes, yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Where did the idea come from?
That was a Hyde Park... Yeah. What we did was, which I'd been doing a lot of fashion, and it was the same thing. I know, if I was doing fashion for some magazine or newspaper, we didn't sort of have 3 days planning and sit in an office working out what we were going to do about it all. I didn't hire lots of models. I used to get one model and then go out, and if we wanted other models, you'd just say, "Hey, come and pose in the picture, sign this release," and that was it. And people would love having that. Perhaps they don't now, but then they loved having their photograph taken. And we just drove around London. "Oh, there's some call boxes. Let's go and do it there." We did some in the Gents in Hyde Park, and they're black and white pictures. The black and white picture, the way they're just sort of standing there, and the guy's doing a flash. Well, he's not doing a flash, but it looks like he's doing a flash. And so that's what I did with all my stuff. I didn't go to photo calls. If I was doing stuff with the Express, they would have owned the copyright. So I used to say to the people, you know, it didn't matter who it was, sort of model or actress or whoever it was, I used to say, these are pictures for Daily Express, can I come take some more, because I'm doing, and which is true, I was doing Swinging London features for everybody, you know, for German, Italian, French.
So is that just freelance work?
Japanese, yeah. Yeah, because I got myself, by luck really, in a position where I'd had them in the New York Times or something, and so then somebody in Japan would ring up and say, can you do the same for us, but different.
So did you used to sort of take some photos for whoever it was, say the Express or whatever, and then have another set of photos that, which were your own?
Yes.
In effect,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
That's very shrewd of you.
Well, I didn't do it with the attention. I did it with the intention of getting two jobs, not with the intention of owning the copyright. But in those days, copyrights didn't matter.
Mm.
But since then, copyrights become the most important thing of all. It's very, very important. And
could you in those days make a fortune on the back of one photo?
No.
Like some people do today?
No. If you were working on the staff of a newspaper, which I never was, I had a freelance contract with the Express. With the Mail. The Express it was. Yeah, the Express. I get confused because Express is such a piss-poor paper now that you don't remember what it used to be like.
Mm.
And I used to get £25 a day for the... My wife, who was the arts reporter, got £25 a week. So, you know, it wasn't fortunes. Mm. But then you got your picture syndicated, and you used to get, like, you probably made, on a really good picture, about £500. Well, £500 now, then, would be, like, £5,000 now. But it's not this sort of £200,000 stuff, you know, for a picture. But so, there are very few. There's lots of exaggeration about it. I mean, that fat Australian, I don't believe half of what he says in his programmes.
What was it like working for a paper like that in those days? Was it hectic, busy?
Oh, yeah, tremendous. But the Express, which had a circulation of 4.3 million when I was there, and now got a circulation of 750 paid circulation. We never had all that nonsense. There was no... You know, if you go on the train, you weren't given a newspaper. They were all sold sales. You know, they were paid for. And it was, yeah, it was hectic because they hadn't got the machines to print the whole paper in one night. I mean, now it's the same thing now with, say, the Sunday Times and all the supplements. They do those on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. But, and then print the paper on Saturday. But in those days, it was, they used to have what they call flong, which was done the day before. If it was coming up north, they only had one place to print it, and that was in London. They did some in Manchester, and a few bit in Scotland, but they went to North Wales. North Wales would have gone from London for some extraordinary reason. So they used to do the flong pages, which used to invent stories, well, not invent, but there were silly stories about girls. You know, this is model and she's going to walk to Australia or something. And I used to do those pictures. I made lots of money out of those.
Excellent. I'm talking to my special guest this hour in conversation with Philip Townsend. Just if you're out and about and you're travelling, coming across the River Mersey, and apparently a bus has broken down in the middle of the Birkenhead Tunnel. They're not sure how long it's going to be taking to clear it. So if you are in a car and you're listening in, maybe you should use the Wallasey Tunnel instead. You're listening to City Talk 105.9.
In conversation with Dean on City Talk 105.9. The Lifelong Learning Network changes lives. Here's what it did for Steve.
I'm a second year medical student at the University of Liverpool. I left school at 16 and joined the Royal Navy, but right the way through my life I'd always had this passion for medicine. And there's lots of people out there like me who have the dream, have the ambition and also have the ability. And all they need is this opportunity, and the Lifelong Learning Network have given me that opportunity.
Find out what the Greater Merseyside and West Lancs Lifelong Learning Network could do for you at citytalk.fm/learning.
We'd like like to take you on a journey. A journey to wherever you'd like to be. At Allerton Mobility, our exceptional range of mobility aids can mean a life without frontiers.
From wheelchairs and bathroom conversions to stairlifts, beds, scooters and more. We can't promise a journey to infinity and beyond, but we've everything you need to boldly go wherever you want to be. So visit 276 Egbert Road, next to Allerton Ceramics, or phone 728 7500.
Allerton Mobility. One giant step for mobility.
A swift business story. Dave's got business documents to sign, and Dave's documents are on the desk in his office in Bootle, but Dave's away doing business in Derby. Thanks to a swift dispatch same-day delivery, Dave can do business in two places at once.
When it comes to business-to-business deliveries, Swift Dispatch is quick, reliable and secure. Call 0845 241 6666 now or visit swiftdispatch.com. Swift Dispatch, the award-winning courier service you can rely on.
Synth pop pioneers and local heroes, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, play the Echo Arena on October 3rd. Book now at aloud.com or call the ticket line on 08701 219 967. McCluskey, Humphreys, OMD. Live in Liverpool at the Echo Arena, Friday, October 3rd.
In conversation with Dean on City Talk 105.9.
In conversation this this middle hour with my guest in the studio, Philip Townsend. If you were listening earlier, I was giving you the news on that broken down bus. It's cleared now, so Birkenhead Tunnel is cleared. Just talking there about your work, Philip, on the with one of the newspapers there. How did you get started in the newspaper business?
Well, it started when my life really changed when I went down to the south of France and met Andrew. Because at the same time, I met this Daily Express reporter, Peter Kinsley, who comes from Newcastle, who's still around. And he said, oh, I'm going to start an agency down here representing the Daily Express number one, but doing it for all the other newspapers. It's going to be south of France and northern Italy, like Turin and Milan, so far as Milan. So he said, do you want to come work for us? So I said, yeah, right. We're not going to pay you, he said, but you can take the pictures and you can have the copyrights. So I was on to it then. So
had you previously been taking pictures then? I presume that you had.
Oh, yeah, because I'd...
On a freelance basis?
Yeah, the Tatler magazine I've been doing stuff for. Now, the way I got that was that my mother was an inveterate gambler, really, really bad. And I went to 27 schools because she used to take me away all the time. And she used to go and... She had a bit of money. In those days, you know, women had trusts, and even though we weren't sort of anything special and we weren't very rich, she had a trust.
Well, I've just been reading that, yeah. Didn't your mother inherit a fortune? But it was held in trust, as it were.
Yeah, it was. It was a fortune, yeah, but it was held in trust.
And so difficult to get hold of.
Yeah, it was Tolly Cobbo, the brewers in Suffolk.
Right.
And there were no male heirs. All she could get was the income, but she manipulated the trustees so that she got money out of it. So she used to send me to... She wouldn't send me to ordinary school, you know. She wouldn't send me to a grammar school or something. She wouldn't do that. No. So she found all these private schools that she used to send me to, and then she used to ring up the trustees and say, could I have Philip's school fees, please? You know, £500 a year. No, I don't know what they were. I think it was quite a lot, actually, £500 a year or something. And she never paid it over. She used to go. She used to go to one of Lady Osborne's, the grandmother of our Conservative Foreign Secretary or whatever he was, Chancellor Exchequer. His mother used to run illegal gambling parties.
Really?
In London, and she was before she was Lady Osborne, she was Mrs. Aspinall, and one of her sons was Aspinall, who started the gambling club as soon as the Gaming Act came in 1961. And I spent my childhood with my mother going to every casino in Europe. And we used to go, like, to Monte Carlo. And we used to stay in a little hotel around the back. So when I went down, you know, when I was 19, Tatler said, go down to Monte Carlo and do Who's Who on the Riviera this year. Well, I was probably one of the few people in those days who knew my way around. So she used to take me to these places.
And did you go into the casinos as well?
Well, it depended on the country. I wasn't allowed, really.
How old would you be?
When I was 7, 8, 9, and 10, she used to take me to Ireland to play poker with the priests. And she had a very good line with the priests, because she used to say, "Oh, hey, think I'll have a little drink." And so they used to give her a cluck, 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 a great big drink, get a piss. And then she used to pour it in the plant, because in those days there were lots of big plants all over the place. and they thought she was pissed, but she always won. And we used to go all over.
I was going to say, she'd make a lot of money on it, though.
Oh, yeah. We used to go all over Ireland.
Almost like a professional gambler.
Yeah, she was. But it was my school fee she was doing it with, you see, because she used to get the school fees and then say, oh, shall we go on a little holiday? And then off we went. When I came back, the school hadn't been paid, so I couldn't go back to that school.
So then she had to go to another one.
And she used to, the other one, she used, if she couldn't get the school fee, like, every 6 months, she used to ring up and say, Philip's very ill. I think I need to take him to Alessio. Well, Alessio in Northern Italy is right next door to San Remo, where there's a big casino. So off we used to go for me to recover, poor child. But if she was winning, she used to go to Monte Carlo. If she wasn't, she used to then move down the coast and go, like, to Alessio, or stay in Alessio and go to San Remo. And then sometimes we went to Baden-Baden in Germany, used to stay in the Grand Hotel where the British World Cup and the England World Cup team stayed 4 years ago. I can't remember what it's called, but it's a fantastic hotel. And we stayed there. And then if she starts losing, we used to go down, and then we might be in a lodging house, you know, double room for me and her.
So she was she a larger-than-life character,
yeah,
colourful
absolutely,
character?
Absolutely. Yes. But I was telling you how I really got involved in all this. What happened was that when the Gaming Act came in 1962, it was all right. You didn't have to go abroad anymore, and you didn't have to go to Lady Osborne's illegal gambling parties.
But basically, you couldn't gamble in this country.
No, you couldn't. No. I mean, there weren't betting shops until.
But tell us about those illegal gambling dens. What used to go on there? Obviously behind closed doors.
Oh yeah, but they weren't. And there were all these sort of what my mother used to call ne'er do wells. They're nearly all right, but they're not quite. And so she used to go every single night. There was a gambling party somewhere
in London.
Yeah, and it wasn't like you know they ring you up on your mobile phone and tell you where it is. It was, oh, well, we'll meet tomorrow at Mrs. So-and-so's. And these people, all sort of people should know better, had these amazing parties. Well, when the Act came in, and also the other thing we used to do was we used to go dog racing in the afternoon. And she used to leave me at home when she used to go.
And what was the situation with the dog racing? Could you gamble on them? No.
Oh yeah.
No, that was okay.
Yes, on the track.
Right.
You could gamble, and there were lots of dog tracks. There was White City. There was Haringey. There were loads, and we used to go
all over London.
Yeah, all over London. We used to go every evening, except Sundays. So that was six evenings, and then she went off to her gambling parties, and I went home, and there were That Stamford Bridge, which is now the Chelsea football ground, there were two meetings there, and there were, I can't remember where the other ones were, but there was some in the afternoon, so we went some in the afternoon, and here was me, completely uneducated, you know. Oh, what are we going to do with you? Anyway, so before any of this happened, she said, what are we going to do with you? And I said, you know, I've got, you know, I'm meant to have these O-levels, and I hadn't got O-levels or anything. So what she did was she sent me to Bournemouth Art School. And after about 6 months, she got a letter from the principal to say, very sorry to say that he didn't think I would ever be able to make a livelihood out of painting because I couldn't draw.
What made her choose Bournemouth?
Well, we were always moving because her trustees, you know, give her any money for anything, but they wouldn't give her money to buy a house, which is madness. So she never, we were always in rented houses. And I had five brothers and sisters who were all much older than me. And she treated them properly, really. I mean, they went to proper schools and, you know, they were all right. But she wouldn't let me go because she was frightened that if she let me go, what would she do? She didn't want to go to the dogs by herself.
So you were her companion then?
I was her companion, yeah. Mm.
And also a means to get her hands on some extra money.
Yeah. That was the main thing, really.
So you're doing the rounds, you know, with the dog tracks, and did you go to any of these illegal gambling meetings?
I only went to a few because...
But what sort of gambling were they engaged in?
Chemin de Fer, which is a game that's not very... played very much now.
Just explain to our listeners who may not know what that is.
It's 21. Unless I saw a table, I don't think I would, because I don't gamble at all.
I was going to say, did you pick up the bug?
Yeah, I was terrible.
Right,
terrible.
Yeah.
And well, anyway, what I was going to say was that when the gaming act came, the second casino that opened was Esmeralda's Barn in Knightsbridge, which was owned by the Crays. And she got very friendly with them.
Oh, did she?
Of course.
Did you ever come across them?
Yeah, lots of times. Yeah. Because I was doing stuff for the Tatler, when I was 19, 20, I used to have what would now be sort of gigs downstairs. The gambling was on the second floor, and I used to have gigs where I used to invite all these sort of air, plum-in-mouth girls and their blokes, and charge them 7 and 6, and they used to dance around. They weren't allowed to have alcoholic drinks, so they bought soft drinks owned by the Crays. And it was raided a few times. And then I started gambling upstairs. I mean, it was terrible.
Was there not any illegal drinking going on in those sort of places?
But the Crays had their cards marked.
Right.
You know, it's the same as it is now. If you're in with the boys in blue, then you can do it. If you're not, you can't. Mm. And they couldn't.
And what were the,
so
what,
they didn't.
What were they like? How old were you when you were sort of coming across?
21, 22.
Right. Yeah. And what were they like?
They were lovely. Really nice. Mm. Really nice. I mean, when they were... On the day that they were arrested, my mother heard it on the radio that these gangsters had been arrested. Oh, no. Oh, dearie me. And she went to my friend Ted, who was the flower seller on the corner of Knightsbridge and Sloane Street, just down the road from Harrods. And he later became Twiggy's bodyguard and travelled the world with Twiggy. But he was a great character. He loved my mum and he liked me. And I went up to him and he said, I've just had your mum here. So I said, yes, terrible state she's in. So I said, oh, yeah, why? Well, she said to me, are Ronnie and Reggie really crooks?
She had no idea. Talking to my special guest this hour, Philip Townsend, a celebrity photographer, reminiscing about the Crays, really. And you said, very affable.
Very affable. Yeah, very nice. Yeah. And Charlie, lovely. Charlie was the cashier in the club. You know, they were kept in the family.
But it came as a shock to your mum when she found out that what they were really up to.
I don't think she'd believed it. She thought they were very badly treated. And I then photographed several times, and I did my same old trick. First time I photographed Lord Boothby.
Oh, yes. He was a colourful character.
Yeah, Lord Boothby was a conservative peer. He was always on the radio, 20 questions he was on nearly every week. Lovely man. And
did he like a drink?
No, not particularly. He liked a boy or two.
Right.
But he didn't like it. The problem with him was...
Oh, that's right, that's what I've just remembered. Yeah, was he involved in some sort of a scandal?
Yes.
Yes.
With the Crays?
Yeah, right.
What happened was, He was silly, because if he'd been more sensible, he would have been all right. What he did was, he continually asked questions in the House of Lords about why the Home Secretary was persecuting the Cray brothers. And so why was this respectable Scottish peer asking questions about the Crays?
Mm.
And I don't think it was the Express, I think it was a couple of other papers did a bit of investigation and found out that he was knocking off Ronnie. And that was the reason. And while he'd never been married, no one suspected that he was that way inclined. But the Crays said, "Don't worry, we'll get your wife." And they got him a wife,
yeah,
who was 40 years younger than him, than them. Although they were, well, no, that's an exaggeration, because she was about 20 and they were about 35, but yeah, 35, 40, so they're 20 years perhaps. And they got him a wife in Sicily.
And he actually married her?
Yeah, and the Duke of Westminster owns the house, number 2, Eaton Square, in which he had a controlled flat. And his wife is still sitting there.
What's a controlled flat?
Well, you know, a controlled tenancy. They can't come out.
Ah, right. And she's still there now?
She's still there now.
So she was, in effect, was she a smokescreen then?
Yeah. Right. Absolutely, yeah. They.
And how long did they have this relationship for?
Until they were arrested.
Right.
And, yeah, she was a nice woman. I photographed them both. Right. Nice, very nice.
And what happened to Lord Boothby in the end?
I died eventually.
Did he...
No, he was...
Was he hounded out?
He was persona non grata.
Mm.
I don't think he used to turn up the House of Lords. I don't think he had any money much. I think his father or his grandfather or whoever started the title was a sort of minister in a Conservative government or a Whig government or something.
What was it like being around then in the 60s? You know, you're describing these colourful characters, Lord Boothby, the Cray twins, your mother as well, you know.
There were so many people, and I've got photographs of them all.
Right.
You know, there were loads.
Lord Lucan, did you ever come across him?
That was later, no, I didn't. I'd sort of gone respectable by then.
Right. But being around in the 60s, did you get that sense that you were actually living through, it sounds a crazy thing to say,
yes,
something to say,
yes.
An era?
Yes, yes. But the terrible thing is that I don't remember. I put all my pictures, when I gave it up, we'll come to that later, but when I eventually gave it up in 1969, I put all my pictures in the cupboard and I didn't look at them for years, some of them. And I had no idea when I got them out what I had. And I'm amazed. I mean, I don't know how. I think I was quite clever to take them. I mean, how did I get them all?
But, you know, looking at them, as I said earlier, I was looking on your webpage and... you know, we always think of the 60s as a black and white era, don't we? Is that how you remember it?
No.
No?
No, it was a very important era. I mean, Twiggy was the first working-class model. Before that, Britain had been controlled by the middle class, who were looking after themselves. Well, it's probably the same now, but it's not the middle class. It's perhaps more people who are more qualified to look after themselves now, but in those days it was a middle class, and they everything was done for them. And if you were stuck in your, look at the Beatles. I mean, they escaped, and Cilla Black and all that lot. I mean, and all the groups here from Liverpool, they all escaped, and they were all the start of it. It was, you know, it was they
it was
got
a revolution.
Down to London. It was amazing, and it's. It had, you know, people go on about the 30s. The 30s was an artistic revolution, but it certainly wasn't a revolution like the 60s. The 60s, everything changed, and it's never changed back. It got boring for me, like, at the end of it, because, you know, lots of people were doing it, and nothing really happened in the 70s. Then you had the punks. But it was amazing. It was truly amazing.
You mentioned Twiggy there. Of course, you took her photograph.
Yeah, several times.
What was she like?
Lovely. But she hasn't changed now. I mean, the thing about Twiggy is that she's got to be talented, because she's not like the celebrities now. I mean, she's had no scandal, ever. You know, there's nothing bad about her. She didn't misbehave. She wasn't a druggie.
What was it about her, do you think, that symbolised the 60s?
She looked different. Before, the models had long, coiffured hair. They were sort of 5'10". I mean, she was five foot seven, probably, 5'7", 8". But she was much thinner. She was much more together. And she's just a really nice person. And she hasn't changed. It hasn't changed her at all. And I mean, there are not many models who are still at it 40 years later.
Exactly. Talking to my special guest this hour, celebrity photographer Philip Townsend.
In conversation with Dean on City Talk 105.9.
Mentioned earlier in the week, this coming Saturday, I'm going to be down at Casper Adam Kitchens, holding a cheese and wine tasting afternoon. On Saturday the 6th of September, I'm going to be hosting the event between 12 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Make sure you pop down, say hello. You'll be able to sample cheese and wine throughout the day whilst having a look around the Casper Adam Kitchen Showroom. The Purple Wine Company will be sharing the expertise on the day too, and we'll be helping you to sample various wines on the day. There's going to be some great competitions for both adults and children, including both art and poetry competitions. Log on to citytalk.fm for all the details of what's going on this Saturday. And I'll see you down there at Casper Adam Kitchens.
You know, I love buffet star. Delicious, mouth-watering, scrumptious, piping hot, healthy Chinese and Thai food. Eat as much as you like for under 6 quid. And talking of squid, don't you just love it pan-fried with lashings of salt and chilli?
Mm-hmm. Buffet Star. 60 delicious Thai and Chinese dishes to choose from for less than 6 quid. Buffet Star. Hanover Street, Liverpool. Just round the corner from Central Station.
Knowsley's new Centres for Learning are on the way. Providing learning, sport, leisure, arts, music, support services and much more for your child and the people of Knowsley.
So as you begin to choose that all-important school place, make a Knowsley Centre for Learning your first choice. More than just buildings, more than just schools. Centres for Learning will be at the heart of the local community, meeting the needs of children, young people and their families.
Knowsley's on the move. To learn more about Knowsley's Centres for Learning, visit knowsley.gov.uk or call 443-2700.
City Talk News.
First with the biggest local stories.
The fact that he can come out with such an immediate response, which apportions 100% of the blame onto one group of people, the Liverpool football fans, well, just shows how pathetic a response it is.
First with national news.
Of that street that firing directly at the entrance of the building.
First for football.
It's a stupid statement, to be fair. The FA Cup can't generate to the likes of Reading what they can get from the Premier League, but that doesn't take away from what the Cup's all about. And he should know, because he's come from the lower divisions as well. So it just shows you sometimes when you do get up there with the big boys, you should think before you let your mouth do the talking.
The voice of Liverpool.
City Talk 105.9. Talk to Tricia on City Talk 105.9.
Hi, I'm Tricia Goddard. Coming up on this Sunday's Talk to Tricia, swapping the circus for the stethoscope, trapeze artist turned paramedic Lisa Walder lifts the lid on life in A&E. Fusing fact and fantasy, Wire in the Blood creator Val McDermid reveals the inspiration behind her latest crime thriller, plus the man making a big name for himself in the world of microsculpture. That's all to come when you join me on Talk to Tricia this Sunday.
Talk to Tricia, Sunday evening at 8 on City Talk 105.9. In conversation with Dean on City Talk 105.9.
And I'm in conversation with my special guest in the studio, Philip Townsend, a celebrity photographer. Philip, ever considered writing a book about the 60s in particular?
Yes.
Yeah?
It has been suggested by lots of people. When Punch magazine was owned by Mohammed Fayyad, I worked there and I did sort of hark back to various things I'd done and wrote articles about it, about my mother and her gambling, actually. Mm. One of them was. But I don't know, it's... everyone says how funny they are, but, you know, books I'm not a 5 minute celebrity, you know. Like I haven't been on a television program, and I'm not sure it would sell. I might do it when I've stopped going round with my photographs, but I'm not going to do it yet, I don't think.
Is it not something that whereby you could do? Because somebody suggested this to me actually, because I've got lots of photographs with lots of different people, and they said you could actually collect all those photos of you with these various, you know, other celebs or members of the royal family or whatever, and just do your reminiscing about the time when that photo was taken.
Yeah, well, I've been going to do books for ages about. I mean, I've got several photography books I can do, and. Oh, it's so difficult. The publishers are very difficult. And if I do it, I'm going to do it myself. I'm going to publish my own books of my pictures. And I'm going to do, the first one's going to be my limited editions, which is like the 125 favourite pictures, and then go around and sell them. So as well as selling prints, I can sell the books. Easier to sell books than prints.
Excellent.
Can't do it yet at this exhibition now, but... You know,
that's the plan.
That's the plan.
So you captured the 60s, you captured the essence of the 60s in your photos. It's interesting as well that, you know, your style, you sort of widen out in the photograph, whereas, you know, a lot of people sort of cropped in, didn't they,
for
newspapers and so on.
That is what I did.
So you were getting a lot of the background in, weren't you?
Yes.
You know, what was going on in 60s London, as it were.
And no one else was doing that.
Yeah, that's what makes them so unique.
Yeah, I think so. And also, they're in the Victoria and Albert Museum and various other museums, National Library of Wales.
Now, at the end of the 60s...
I think because of that.
End of the 60s, you decided to pack your camera away. Why was that?
Well, the Daily Express sent me down to... There was a guy called Walker Smith, who I think was Foreign Secretary, and he'd been sacked. And they sent me down to number 2 Cotton House Terrace to take his snap when he left the building.
Was that where his office was?
No, it was, no. Well, I think it's his residence.
Right, official residence. Yeah.
No, because the foreign office is a great big, great big block. It was his official residence, and all the boys were there. It wasn't like the paparazzi, because there was no paparazzi. You know,
were they gentlemen in those days then, gentlemanly behaviour?
They were better than they are now, and they weren't. Perhaps they were staff photographers. They were like reporters, and they wore suits and ties. You had to go to work in a suit and a tie and all that. And all the boys were there, and you know, the Express, the Mail, the Sketch, and all the papers. They all had their own photographers. Daily Express had 52 photographers.
Really?
Now the national papers have one or two or none, because they buy them.
They buy
Getty's and all the Getty's agency and lots of people like that, and. This guy from the Mirror said, look, boys, he's definitely going to come out the back. So I didn't think he'd come out. Why should he come out the back? He wasn't hiding, you know, and he had a career afterwards. Even in those days, they were getting jobs in private business after they were cabinet ministers. I thought, no, he's definitely going to come out. So they all went trotting around the back. And it was just me. Oh, and also in those days, they didn't have... cine cameras. They couldn't, you know, if they did have a cine camera, it was a cine camera. It was a great big thing. And so there was not hundreds of television companies outside. There weren't any television companies, BBC and ITV, but the ITV didn't have much news. And so we all went around the back, all except me. And I stayed at the front. And after about 20 minutes, out he comes, gets in his official car. I get a taxi and follow him. No mobile phones. So I follow him. He then went to his house, where his other house in Hampstead. And I then went and got a call box and rang the picture desk. And they said, I've got a passport. So I said, yes. They said, follow him down. Wherever, if he goes abroad, go with him. So I went down to London Airport. And we went off to Paris. And I thought, here's this guy saying, I know what they're going to do. I've been doing this for 45 years. I know exactly what they're going to do. They're all going to come out the back. I thought, do I seriously, in 45 years, which is about now, want to be still standing outside Carlton House Terrace? In fact, I wouldn't have done, because if I hadn't gone to work for an agency, and I've been too old, because they're all lads that they pay, you know, 15,000 a year to. I would have gone mad, so that's why I gave it up. And also, it was great up to 68, and then everything had changed so much that there wasn't much happening. You know, people were consolidating their position. The breadheads were getting richer. You know, the boys who weren't really in it for the hippiness of it, they were in it for the money. And a lot of the hippies had got ill through drugs, and it was all getting boring. So I gave it up. And I did journalism. I wrote a few things.
Talking, as you were there, about following your quarry, as it were, you followed Rex Harrison as well, didn't you? Tell us about that.
I did, yes. I did. Rex Harrison married Rachel Roberts, who I think was his third wife. And I was in the Express, and they got a letter, and they'd run a story the previous day about whether Rex Harrison was going to marry this woman, Rachel Roberts, and next day there was this letter from a chambermaid at the at Claridge's Hotel saying, well, if they're not going to get married, I don't know what they're doing with the sheets. And so we all had a meeting. I mean, I didn't have a meeting because I was a mere photographer, but the management had a meeting and decided to put a photographer on the house. So they put a photographer on the house, and he followed them down to London Airport and find out. He didn't follow them, but he found out that they were going to Portofino in Italy. So they sent me down there. And the Splendido is the hotel that, in the Sunday Times, Michael Winner goes on about all the time, one of the best hotels in Europe. And it was, you know, the papers haven't got any money now, so they don't spend any money. But in those days, they used to charter jets and,
But perhaps real glamorous life.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. Anyway, so I went down there and I stayed with a reporter in the Splendido for 3 weeks. And we used to stand outside his house. And his house was a very, very narrow drive, and he could only get up to it in a Jeep. He had a Jeep that used to drive up frontwards, and then they used to drive down backwards. That's the only way to get to the house. And I followed them for 3 weeks, and eventually they went to the registry office. And that's the first time I ever met the paparazzi in Italy, because the paparazzi had started in... There weren't many of them, but there were a few.
And they were out in force, were they?
Well, three or four of them, yes. Yeah, force for those days.
So did you get one of the first pictures then to be back this country?
I did. Yeah. Yeah, I got the picture, I think, because they let me go into the registry office and then anyone else.
I'm in conversation with my special guest this hour, Philip Townsend. Philip, did you ever get to take any snaps of the Royals in your time?
Not really. I've never photographed the Queen, but a dear friend of mine, Roger Eldridge, who was the Queen's advisor on photography, he was very ill.
What did that entail doing?
Well, they have things called I can't remember what they're called, but it's a thing where one photographer represents all the newspapers, and one photographer represents all the magazines, and one photographer represents all the agencies. That's what it used to be. And I think it still is. And he used to compile the lists and all that stuff. And
the lists of
who was going to do what, you know.
Right.
And I used to always do them for Daily Express. These rotors, they're called.
Right.
I used to always do the rotors, so that if she went, if you went to a film premiere, the boys could take the pictures outside, but they weren't allowed in. And then I took the pictures inside, and they were shaking hands with the people who've been in the play, or if it's the Royal Command performance, all those pictures. So I did that. I got a picture, which are of Marlon Brando, who is one of the icons of the 60s. Marlon Brando with Princess Alexandra.
What were they up to?
Well, more than we think, so I'm told.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. So what was your photograph of?
Oh, they were just dancing.
Right.
They were just dancing. And then they told me to F off, so I did.
Which one of them told you to do that?
She did.
Oh, well, there you go. That's interesting. You heard it first on City Talk 105.9. And, of course, the Beatles. You captured the Beatles.
Oh,
of course
yes.
You did.
Yeah, they didn't.
Yes,
they were great. I photographed the Beatles lots of times. From the very early days, right at the last pictures I took of them was in 1967, and that's the pictures which are on show at the exhibition in Chester.
Which brings us nicely around to that. That's the exhibition in Chester.
Watergate Gallery. Starts tonight.
Yep.
It's on for a month.
On for a month. Excellent. So apart from that, because we're just coming to the end of our time now, Philip, apart from things like the exhibitions, what else occupies your time these days?
Having exhibitions. I'm going to get my books organised.
Yeah.
I do cards. All sorts of things, really.
Excellent. Well, yes. Philip, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I hope you have a great time in Chester this evening at the exhibition. And I hope it's a huge success for you. Thanks for being my guest.
Thanks.
That's my special guest in conversation with Philip Townsend. You're listening to The Sullivan Show with me, Dean Sullivan, here on City Talk 105.9.